the dynasty of the House of David, the kings of Judah, as recorded for us in the book of Malachim, is a mixed picture. In fact, the entire history of the Jewish people in their own homeland, in their own country, is a disquieting one. From the time of Yoshua ben Nun, when the first Jews came to Eretz Yisrael as an organized community, throughout the ages, the Jews in Eretz Yisrael have found it to be very difficult to really live up to the demands of the country and to the expectations of their people and their Creator. After David died and his son Shlomo became the king, Shlomo's main task was to solidify the empire, which he did. He made the empire of Judah, the empire of Israel, one of the main countries in the world, in fact, the leading country in the world, and he built the Beis HaMikdash. However, in his reign already, when you're on top of the world, there's only one way to go, unfortunately. When you're the champion, then there are no more heights to climb. And during his reign already, the cracks in the foundation became apparent. When he died, as I discussed with you before, when we discussed Rehavam and Yerovam, the kingdom split, and it split permanently and badly. The majority of the Jewish people went away from the house of David. They followed Yerovam, and Yerovam successfully undermined their connection to Jerusalem and, to a great extent, their connection to Jewish tradition and to the God of Israel. During the entire period of time when Israel was a separate kingdom, the northern tribes, there was never a period when they were able to overcome the pagan influences. All of the kings of Israel, without exception, even Jehu, who was appointed by the prophet, all of the kings of Israel not only did not stem the tide of paganism, but unfortunately encouraged it and made idol worship the state religion of the northern state. Judah was left as a small, almost defenseless country to the south of its big brother of Israel. And what Yehuda had going for it were three things. Number one, that it was the heir to the dynasty of David HaMelech, the house of David, which had a great effect on the Jewish people and solidified the government in a way that the northern kingdom never experienced. Because even though there would be, as we will see in a few moments, there would be coups and assassinations and all the other problems that come with monarchy, with absolute monarchy, even all of that would occur in Judah, with the exception of a very short period of time, there never was really a diversion from the house of Judah. There never, from the house of David, there never were the conflicting dynasties and new kings that was the hallmark of the northern kingdom. The second thing they had going for them was the temple, was that the Beis HaMikdash was in Yerushalayim. The first Beis HaMikdash was a living, physical manifestation, kaviyochel, of God's presence amongst the Jewish people. And that, therefore, that served as an influence, it served as a break against all of the conflicting times and tides, and it served to lessen the hold that idolatry otherwise would have had over the people. And the third thing they had going for them was the Nevi'im, the prophets. Even though the northern kingdom also had prophets, but the influence of the prophets in the kingdom of Judah was much greater. And the fact that many of them were royal themselves and related to the royal house, all of that combined to create a buffer, a protective coating that did not allow Yehuda to slip away in the same fashion that the northern kingdom did. And therefore, even when Yehuda would be destroyed and the temple would be burned to the ground and the Jewish people would be taken into exile, Yehuda would be taken into exile, they would be able to survive. Because the tradition, so to speak, was intact. The tradition of Torah, the tradition of belief, and even though vast numbers of Jews would be lost, but the centrality of Jewish life would be able to be preserved. And that fundamental difference between the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, and the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, is emphasized over and over again in the book of Malachim and the book of Kings. It becomes the dividing line between the two countries. And we will also see in a few moments that the countries didn't get along with each other, and that they did terrible things to each other, and that they went to war against each other a number of times. Fratricide is almost endemic to the Jewish people. And it's only in the long exile that the Jewish people have ever presented more or less a united front. And even then, it was more on the surface than in reality. But in its own country, the Jewish people have always been divided, and divided severely, and divided to the point of civil war, both in the first temple and in the second temple. And one has to therefore view all of these matters in some sort of perspective, because the perspective of Jewish life has to be seen. And to a certain extent, as bad as things are today regarding the Jewish people, it's an improvement over what existed before. At least until now, nobody's taking up Uzis against each other. It's only words and posters and vehemence. But it's still manageable. But we'll see that here it was not manageable at all. It was terrible things are done. And naturally, terrible things are always done in the name of God and country. They are never done for base motives. And in fact, the more noble the motive, the worse the things that are being done are. Because if you're doing it for a holy purpose, then everything is permissible. Shlomo's son Rehavam when he became the king, so he ruled for 17 years. He was 41 years old when he became the king. Now, the Tanakh describes him in a very interesting fashion. The Tanakh says, Vayas Yehuda hara b'nei Hashem. The kingdom of Judah, the people of Judah, did what was wrong. They slipped into idolatry. They imitated their northern brothers. They liked what Yerovam ben Nevat instituted, his reforms. But it doesn't say that Rehavam himself slipped. But he was a very ineffectual king. And in fact, his main mistake was allowing the northern kingdom to break off. His foolish statement that my father whipped you with whips and I will whip you with scorpions. His attempt to raise the taxes, his attempt to extort more from the people. The fact that he was completely out of touch with what was happening. All of that reflected itself in his entire reign. And when he was the king, so the king of Egypt came, Sheshach, came against the city of Jerusalem, and he captured the city of Jerusalem, and he forced the city of Jerusalem to pay him ransom. He took all of the treasures that Shlomo, the father of Rehavam, had stored in the temple of God, and all of the personal treasures of the king, and all of the personal treasures of the monarchy, the museums, the palaces. Jerusalem was the center of the world. He sacked it. And he took everything away. He even took, it is told us in Tanakh, that the honor guard of Shlomo had golden shields. you know, that they stood, you know, the king's guards. He took all of that away. And Rehoboam was forced to replace the golden shields with bronze shields. And that was seen as a, publicly seen as a humiliation. And the entire atmosphere, the morale of the people sank. And to a great extent, he himself died of a broken heart, having in 17 years lost what it took 80 years to put together before him, what his grandfather and father had achieved. And not only had he lost the empire, and not only had he lost the northern kingdom, and not only had he lost the treasures, he lost the people, which is the worst of all losses. And he also lost the religion to a great extent, because now idol, not only was idol worship prevalent, but his own son, the next king, Avium, was an out-and-out idolater himself. And he brought upon the southern kingdom only disaster. He was only a king for 3 years, which mitigates the disaster somewhat. Sometimes you have people who are in power for a long period of time, and the fact that they themselves were in power for so long is what seals the doom of the empire. We have many such instances in history. One of the later Louis in France, the Sun King, who was in power for almost 60 years. To a certain extent, Franz Josef in the Habsburg Empire. It's a good idea, you know, except for rabbis, it's a good idea to change every so often. That's right. Mayor Koch. I mean, people outlive their... in power, there's a certain period of time, and then if you outlive it, so then problems arise. They must arise. So here he was the king only for 3 years. Now during the entire time that Rehoboam, his father, was the king, and Avium was the king, there was an open war between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Not the Cold War, but an open war. Border skirmishes, fighting, armies. Casualties, Jews killing Jews. And there was, as I mentioned to you, the Tanakh tells us that Yerovam shut the border, closed the border so Jews couldn't go south to Jerusalem. All of this existed. It was a terrible time for the Jewish people. And for the first time, you had a king of Israel, for the first time, you had a king of Israel that was himself an out-and-out worshiper of idols. We're not talking about Yerovam ben Nevat. I'm talking about from the house of David. So he had two kings of Israel, Yerovam ben Nevat in the north, Avium in the south, both of whom worshipped idols. The Tanakh itself comments that why the Lord did not pick up his marbles and leave is because of his commitment to the house of David and his commitment to the Jewish people. God has infinite patience. I mean, if he puts up with us as he does, it's a hard people, the Jewish people. And God doesn't give up on us. He has infinite patience with us. So the Tanakh phrases it that because of the fact that the Lord had made the commitment to David, and he made the commitment to the Jewish people, so he wasn't going to give up, even though, I don't know how to phrase it, but it's hard to justify his staying. Now we see a pattern that we're going to see regarding the house of Yehuda, is that children undo what their fathers do. So that if the father was an idolater, the next king who was his child is a tzaddik. And then if the king was a tzaddik, then his child is an idolater. It's almost a conscious will. There are exceptions. But there is a pattern here, and the pattern is up and down, back and forth. And the pattern is child against father. I imagine, I can't be certain of it, but I think the psychology of the matter is that many times the child takes over the business, so he wants to change everything. You see that in the business world as well. That the father gives over the business to the child, the child changes the nature of the business, he changes the personnel. He wants to assert himself. So even though everything that the father did was successful, many times it turns out disastrous. And then sometimes it turns out fortuitous. You never know. But that's the pattern that we have here also. And he had a son called Osso, who was one of the great and righteous kings of Yehuda, one of the heroes of Tanakh, really. And he was a king for a long period of time. He was the king for 41 years. So Rehoboam was 17 years, and Avihom was 3 years. So he had a period of 20 years of idolatry and of decline. And then Osso comes and turns it around. It's interesting, the Tanakh describes also, it says, Vayas Osso HaYoshor Bene Hashem, Osso did what was correct in the eyes of God, Kidovid Oviv, as his father David. In other words, Tanakh sees him as a throwback to David, because he's not his father, and he's not his grandfather, and he's not even his great-grandfather Shlomo. He's more than that. He is the king that restores what David attempted to do. And it describes for us in detail in Tanakh, he made a clean sweep of the idolatry. He cleared out the prostitution in the country, the sexual immorality. He took all the idols and destroyed them. He even took his mother, who was one of those who supported the idols, and he removed her. And the groves of trees that they worshipped, and the tapestry that they wove, it was an entire society with an entire structure and an entire ritual. All of that was destroyed. And he took them all and he burned them in the river of Kidron. And he was able to do everything. Only one thing he could not do. And no king of Israel, no king of Judah was able to do that. And that was to remove the bomos. The bomos were private altars that people had in their own houses or communities. And instead of going, so most of the bomos were to idols. But there were bomos that were not to idols, they were to God. It was a mizbeach to worship God, to bring sacrifices to Ribono Shel Olam. However, and we know that very carefully, that the bomos were nevertheless usher, because we have a halacha that whenever there was a central Beis HaMikdash, the bomos were not allowed. You were not allowed to have private. I mean, that concept of a central place of worship is part of the halacha. It's part of the halacha even regarding a synagogue. There's halacha barovom hadras melech. It's better to have one shul that has 100 people than to have two shul that are 50 people. So the Jewish people resolved that by having 10 synagogues with 10 people. And that's a if you think about it, that's self-destructive. But it's almost impossible to uproot. And because of that nature, which we see already in the time of the Tanakh, great tragedies have befallen us, great weakness. All sorts of things have happened and continue to happen to us. The bomos that were part and parcel of Jewish life also was unable to uproot them. He was unable to stop it. And because he stopped all the idolatry, but he didn't stop the bomos. What happened was that when another king would come, and that other king would be an idolater, the bomos automatically reverted to idolatry because they were there, right? I mean, if you've got a mizbeach, use it. If there's an altar, then we have to use it. So, and then Jews are funny, right? They use it for God, good. They use it for the eagle, also good. They use it for whatever, but it's got to be there. And that concept, that weakness, remained within the Jewish people all of the time. Now, Osa continued the war with the kingdom of the north. The king of the north in his reign was Baasha. And Baasha was a very powerful king. As I mentioned to you, the northern kingdom was much more powerful than the southern kingdom. And Baasha came and he took away pieces of Yehuda, cities, villages, just took them away. And he was so powerful that he threatened Jerusalem. In order to make certain that Jerusalem would not fall, Osa bribed him. How did he bribe him? He didn't pay the bribe to Baasha because he hated him too much. He paid the bribe to the king of Aram, Ben-Hadad, the Aramaic Empire, headquartered in Damascus, and he paid them money that they should scare off Baasha. They should scare off the northern kingdom of Israel. So here you have, again, a classic occurrence, which unfortunately has occurred and reoccurs so many times in Jewish history, is that one Jew, in order to gain advantage over the other Jew, or one Jewish group in order to gain advantage over another Jewish group, or one Jewish country in order to gain advantage over another Jewish country, turns to the non-Jewish world for help. Brings them into it. And that always spells disaster. And unfortunately, even today, we are not free of that plague. And that's a terrible thing. If you want to have matters in Israel, for instance, go your way, don't have 30 senators from the United States Senate write a letter for you. But that's the classic pattern. Jews have always done that. That's how the Romans came to the country. The Jews in their civil war brought in the Romans. You know, once the bear came to eat lunch, so he's going to stay for supper also. And in the time of the Russian Tsars, the Maskilim, in order to, the, you know, those that were enlightened, so to speak, in order to obtain the necessary educational reforms that they wanted within the Jewish people, made an alliance with the Russian Tsar that he should enforce it for them. And once the Russian Tsar got interested in the Jews, by the time everybody woke up that he was out to destroy them, it was too late. That's a classic Jewish pattern, and that we see during the reign of King Osa. He pays a bribe to the king of Aram in order to keep Baasha, the king of Israel, out of Yerushalayim. And he does so. He's happy to do so. And Baasha is naturally frightened off. Baasha doesn't want a two-front war with Judah on the south and Damascus on the north. So he has to relent. But he doesn't forget. The people from the northern kingdom don't forget that. And that only guarantees that it's going to happen again. And the shifting alliances which continue here over and over again just further build up this situation that the two warring countries, the two warring Jewish countries, are constantly bringing in outside empires to support themselves, until finally it becomes so overwhelming that the two Jewish countries have to unite to throw out the empire. And then once that happens, then they have time to fall back and fight among themselves again. The Tanakh is a startling book. has a startling pattern of history to it. The Tanakh reads like today's, it's more relevant than today's newspaper. And that's why it's written here, because in the Tanakh are the natural instincts and all the errors that Jewish communities make among themselves. Now, Basho attempted to defeat Aram, and he himself was overcome. Basho, by the way, was the king that destroyed the entire house of Yeravam. He sets up a new dynasty, which will not last, as we discussed in the lecture regarding the northern kingdoms. When Asa dies, then his son Yehoshaphat becomes the king. Yehoshaphat is the king for 25 years. Yehoshaphat is the son of Asa. And during his time, Aram declined. There was a period of time, an interval of peace. What is called peace in the Middle East, my friends? 3 years. That's what the Tanakh says. For 3 years, there was no war. So that was peace. Peace broke out. In the period of the Shoftim, we read that the longest period of time was the 40-year reign of the prophetess Dvorah. There it says, and the earth and the land was quiet for 40 years. So that the Tanakh took note of it because that was such an unusual event. Here are 3 years. During this period of peace, Yehoshaphat attempted to make peace with the king of Israel. He is now prepared to bury the hatchet. So the war had gone on for almost 65 years. So he's now ready to reconcile. And he says to him, let us together make war against Aram. Together we will free ourselves from Aram. Aram had conquered parts of the Golan and parts of the Gilad. And we'll capture our territory back, and we'll be able to deal that way. That we'll be the strongest country in the area. Now, he does not propose that they unite, because that was too radical a proposal. And neither king would give up. Neither king would go up. Would relinquish his right, his mastery, his dynasty. But at least they would unite to fight Aram. Yehoshaphat was a righteous man. Yehoshaphat was like his father also. Was also unable to remove the bomos. But he was not a worshiper of idols. He was not like the king of Israel. A rabbi's comment that Yehoshaphat's undoing was the fact that he went with Arosha. He went with the evil king. Should have stayed away. Even though it looked like a good combination, Chazal always paid great heed to the rule of Al Tischaber LaRosha. Don't join of your own volition the Rosha, the evil person, because by so doing, the evil person rarely, if ever, is improved, and you certainly will be weakened and destroyed. And in fact, the fate of what happens to the evil person will become your fate. You adopt it. You adopt the punishment, that role. Now, Yehoshaphat, before he goes to war, says, well, let's ask the prophet, because in Judah they still respected the prophets. The kings of the north, the kings of the north they did not respect the prophets of God. In fact, they not respect them is an understatement. They killed them. They were not able to brook any interference with their plans. They wanted not only yes men, they wanted people that were sycophants, people that would always approve of what they said. And the true Navi of God was usually a very ornery person. He was a very contrary person. He was there to tell the king, you're wrong. Don't you dare do it. God is not with you. And because of that, the kings of Israel always destroyed the Nevi'im. So he said, isn't there one Navi left? Yehoshaphat said, he said, yeah, there's one Navi. His name is Michyol. And Michoyu, he's alive. But I don't want to call him, he said, because he's my enemy. He's not going to tell me the news that I want to hear. And the king of Judah said, please, let's call him. Now the king of Israel had a famous Navi, who was the court Navi, who was, he wasn't a Navi, but he was the official prophet, the PTL of his time. And his name was Tzidkiyahu ben Kenaana. And he, in order to show the message, so the Tanakh tells us he made horns of iron and he put them on his head. And he said, with these horns you shall gore Aram. Go to war and you'll be Matzliach. Michoyu comes. And when Michoyu comes, he says, whoever wants to go is going to get killed. When he said that, so the king of Judah said, I'm not going. All right? I'm not going. And the situation was such that the whole campaign is in jeopardy. If he goes home, Yehoshaphat, the whole campaign is in jeopardy. So in the Tanakh it tells us that Tzidkiyahu walked up to Michoyu and he hit him. He smote him across his face. And he said, why do you invent these things? God never spoke to you. And Michoyu is arrested and taken into prison, put in the dungeon, because nobody likes to hear the truth. It's much easier to hide it. And Yehoshaphat is convinced, against his own better judgment, to proceed with the campaign. And what happens is that he is killed. He is killed. And when that happened, so then the army fell apart. Ahav is killed in the war also. And this is the fulfillment of the prophecy that the prophet said, that the Jewish people would be defeated, the kings would be killed. And he was defeated. Yehoshaphat, the king of Yehuda, who was defeated in the war, is a symbol of the fact that Al Tischaber Lo Rosha, that he should not have gone together with Ahav. And that a noble purpose sometimes is undone by the people who are not so noble that participate in it. And that's a basic lesson, again, of Jewish history. And it's a difficult lesson to assimilate, and it's even more difficult to apply. But in the Tanakh we see that that was what happened to Yehoshaphat. And he... he is a victim of this terrible event. His son Jehoram, who succeeds him, Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, is a king for only 8 years. And now what happened was that we have an alliance between the house of Ahav. Originally, you know, that's the way life is. Originally, they were just going on a campaign together. Eventually, they become mechutanim. They got married to each other. And Ahav's, there are two opinions, but it's Ahav's daughter, Atalio, or some say it's Ahav's sister, Atalio, becomes the wife of Jehoram, the king of Judah. So the queen of Judah is the blood relative of Ahav, the king of Israel. She comes with idolatry. She comes with paganism. She comes with the entire Canaanite worship of her mother, Jezebel. She comes with all the cruelty of Ahav. She is the single greatest disaster that strikes the kingdom of Judah. And she's a scheming woman and a very powerful woman and adept at all court intrigues. And Jehoram, who in the Tanakh comes off as not a very strong person, someone who was easily dominated by his wife, Jehoram slips again into idolatry. So he had a period of time of also in Jehoshaphat when the southern kingdom was free of idolatry. Jehoram, under the influence of Atalio, of his wife, reinstitutes idolatry. So that now both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom are united in the fact that they have forsaken God. And it says that he went in the ways of Ahav. He went in the ways of the family of his wife. The Tanakh says, Ki bas Ahav hoy salo liisha. The daughter of Ahav, the sister of Ahav, was his wife. Like the Tanakh is saying, how could you expect anything different? It's strange to imagine how Jehoshaphat agreed to such a marriage. Jehoshaphat, who was a righteous king, but there were undoubtedly political reasons, other reasons, and maybe there's a certain amount of naivete also, that she'd come into the house of Jehoshaphat, he would reform her, he'd make her a good lady, he'd be able to straighten her out. There are many good people who have that naive feeling that, you know, there's no person they can't handle, there's no situation they can't handle, they can do it. And that's a terrible danger. So during the reign of King Jehoram, again, the Torah, the Tanakh tells us that God would have forsaken the Jewish people completely. There was no reason to continue anymore. So bad had the situation become. But again, the same idea that I mentioned to you before, the Tanakh says that God did not want to destroy Judah because of what he had promised to his servant to David, and he had promised to the Jewish people those old commitments. And therefore, the kingdom kept on going. During the reign of this king, Jehoram, one of the few territories which Judah had dominion over, which was the territory of Edom. Edom is the Negev, the southern part of the Negev piece of this of the Arabian Peninsula. That's where Edom lived. And the Tanakh tells us, for instance, that Jehoshaphat had a seaport at Eilat, just as today Israel's port on the Red Sea was Eilat. So, and he built, he attempted to build a fleet of 10 boats, and he couldn't get the boat builders correctly, you know. The boats didn't float. Kings are notoriously poor boat builders. In Stockholm, there's a boat called the Vasa that was built by the king of Sweden, Charles, who was one of the great emperors of the world, and he built this boat, and he forced the boat architects to build it to his specifications. And the boat could not, it just couldn't go. I mean, the boat was so top heavy. On its maiden voyage, it went 300 yards in the port of Stockholm in the bay, off the pier, and it sank. 488 people were drowned. The king had the architect, the boat architect, put on trial for building the boat. And he could not raise the defense that the king told him to build a boat that way, because then that would be less a majesty, that would cast an insult against the king. So he languished for quite a while till the king forgot about him. That boat, by the way, sank in a sandbar, and it was covered by sand for over 300 years, and they raised it in 1960. And it's on exhibition. It's a museum, the Vasa Museum in Stockholm. And you can walk through the boat, and you can see it. And it's ludicrous, because the tip of the boat, the bottom of the boat is so narrow, and it's so unseaworthy, and the masts and everything were so enormous, and the weight is so enormous that you don't even know how it got 300 yards downstream in the port itself. But kings are notoriously poor boat makers. The king of Yehuda, Yehoshaphat, also was not a good boat maker. But he had this port at Eilat. In order to keep the road to the port open, they had to control Edom, because Edom lived between Yehuda. Yehuda ended effectively at Beersheba. So between Beersheba and Eilat, the entire Negev, they had to control the road. They had to control the access to the port. And in the reign of Yoram, they lost control of it. And Edom revolted and proclaimed their own government, and they appointed their own king. And so he was forced to go to war with them. And he had other rebellions, one after the other. Again, the empire of Judah begins to disintegrate. Whatever is left, out of punishment of the fact that he reverted to idolatry. And Yoram died after 8 years, and his son Ahaziah became the king. Ahaziah was 22 years old. He was the son of Ataliah and Yoram. He was the king for almost a year, and then his mother had him assassinated. Nice lady. Ahaziah went to visit the king of Israel to be Mavaker Chole, and what happened was that when he came there, so he walked right into the middle of the revolution of Yehu against the house of Ahav, and he was assassinated. There are Mephorshim that say that his mother contributed to the assassination, that his guards purposely left him, and that he was killed. Now, what happened was that she saw an opportunity. The opportunity was that she was going to destroy the entire household of David. Her son was dead. The other children that were alive were from other wives. And she saw a golden opportunity. Her entire family had been destroyed in the northern kingdom. She was out to wreak revenge against what happened, and against the Jews in the south, and she therefore killed the entire family of David. Anybody that was related to the house of David, she killed. And only one child survived. It was her grandson, Yoash, who was the son of Ahaziah. So Ahaziah was her son. So he was killed, he died. Yoash, who was the son of Ahaziah, and who was then a very young child, he was only 1 year old. So she wanted to kill him too. because he was a direct descendant of the house of David. And she wanted to take over the reins of the government completely and rule. So he was able to escape. He and his nurse was able, they were able to hide in the bedroom, and the guards did not find them, and eventually they escaped, and they took up residence with the Kohen Gadol, with Hilkiah the Kohen Gadol, where they hid. And they waited 6 years. For 6 years she was the queen. In those 6 years, it was chaos. It was pandemonium. You can't imagine. The Kohanim barely could keep the services going in the temple. Idols all over the place. Immorality, taxes. She was a woman that really she lost her mind. I mean, the power went to her head. She was just wild. And the entire country came to a standstill. So the Kohanim that were left, that were loyal to the Rabboni Shel Olam and to the house of David, and the people that were still loyal to the house of David, and the prophets, the Nevi'im, they conspired against her, and they had her assassinated. So we have here a very bloody period. Period that, again, is reminiscent of what we read in later history about other nations, of coups and assassinations and plots. And Ataliah was assassinated. When he was assassinated, Yoash was made the king. The grandson Yoash became the king. Yoash was 7 years old when he became the king. So he was a king in name only for the first few years, because he was such a small child. So the Kohanim, Yo-Yodo HaKohen, Yo-Yodo was the Kohen that saved him. I didn't mean Chilkio. Yo-Yodo was the Kohen that saved him. And Yo-Yodo was the regent. And Yehoash would be the king for 40 years, long period of time. And Yehoash was one of the great righteous kings of Judah. One of the great kings of Judah, who really restored the halo, if I may say so, to the family of David. He was a throwback again to David. And during the reign of Yehoash, he rebuilt and refurbished the Beis HaMikdash. Because the Beis HaMikdash, which was now 200 years old, had not had a major maintenance job. It was a little like the Williamsburg Bridge. It hadn't had a major refurbishing all of the years. And not only that, the kings that were in favor of idolatry purposely wanted the temple to fall into disrepair. They wanted it to look insignificant in comparison to the temples of the idols. They wanted it to be secondary to the idolatrous behavior and the idolatrous temples which existed. And therefore, Yehoash undertook this great Bedek Habayis, the refurbishing of the Beis HaMikdash, and it was a long campaign of many years, but the Beis HaMikdash was refurbished in his time, and all the idols were removed. Again, the Bomos didn't stop. But other than that, it was a great success, the reign of Yoash. Yoash also rebuilt the empire of Judah. He defeated Aram. And he was a great and strong king. When Yehoash died, then Amatzia, his son, became the king. And Amatzia was also a good king, like his father, Yehoash. But like his father, he also was unable to restore it to its original greatness because of the fact that the Bomos were not present. During the reign of Amatzia, he was able to reconquer Edom, to take back that entire piece of the Negev, to reopen the port of Eilat. He was able to strengthen the borders. And then Amatzia undertook to try and conquer Yisrael. He is the first king that wanted forcibly to reunite the Jewish empire. He wanted to make Yisrael, the northern kingdom, come under the domination of the house of Yehuda. Again, the prophet tells him not to go. The prophet tells him that it's a losing venture, that God will not be with you. And even though he was a good king, and he was a great king, and he was a pious king, we see also a pattern here in Tanakh, is that they didn't like the prophets to mix in politics. You know, as long as you were in the shul, and you pasuk and the shailas and halacha, that was good, but they didn't want the prophets to tell them how to run the government. And they didn't want them to be their generals, and to tell them whether they would be successful in war or not. They felt that that was an interference. And therefore, I think that that helps explain why throughout the Tanakh you see complete disregard of the words of the prophets when it comes to these matters, even though these kings are righteous, and even though they're good. But it's like a blind spot to them. One would think that they would have gotten the message after it happened so many times that the prophets of Israel said to kings, don't go to war. And if you go to war, you're going to be defeated or you're going to be killed. Why do they keep on going? Well, aside from the honor that's involved, it is simply that they felt that it was not the place of the prophet. It almost was a suicidal bent on their part to establish the authority of the king over the prophet. And we find that later in Jewish life also, in the time of the Second Temple, where the kings disregarded, no longer were their prophets, but they disregarded the words of the rabbis, the words of the Sanhedrin, and many times in the Sanhedrin itself, they disregarded what the Talmidei Chachomim had to say, not out of the fact that they felt that what they had to say was wrong, but simply it was not their business. They were not there to comment upon it. That was not their role. And to a certain extent, you know, you stay there in the synagogue, you stay there in the Beis HaMedrash, you stay in the study hall. We have nothing that you, it's not your concern. And in order to establish that clearly, so many times they almost willingly went to their death, and they took their army down the tubes with them too, but they were going to prove that they were right, that it was their prerogative and not that of the prophet. So Amatzia went to war against Yisrael, against the northern kingdom, and he lost the war, and he was captured by Yehoash, the king of Israel, captured Amatzia, the king of Judah. And in order to make the point even stronger, the army of Israel came to Jerusalem and tore down part of the wall, which was a great humiliation. In the ancient world, that was tearing down the defense wall of the opponent was like burning his flag publicly. It was rubbing it in. It was showing them that they really lost. He also took away all of the gold and silver that had been collected in Jerusalem, all of the treasure of the temple itself, all of the king's treasure, the monies that had not been spent on the refurbishing, that were put aside for the continued maintenance of the temple, all was taken and taken back to Shomron, to the northern kingdom, as booty. And Amatzia eventually was assassinated. He was assassinated by a group of generals who felt that they could run the country better. And when he went to Lachish, and there in the city of Lachish, the army conspired against him. They assassinated him and they killed him. When that happened, the people refused to leave the house of David. They demanded that the king be from the house of David. That was a healthy instinct in the Jews of Yehuda, that they did not follow the ways of the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom, whenever there was an assassination, the generals that had the assassination became the king. That did not happen here. And instead his son, who was then 16 years old, the son's name was Azariah, but he's known to us as Uzziahu, or Uzziah. He became the king. And Uzziah was the king for 52 years. For 15 years while his father lived, and then 37 years after his father lived, and after his father's death. And he was a great and pious and righteous king. However, he also fell to the blandishments of power, because he wanted, just as his father ignored the prophets, he ignored the Kohanim, and he demanded a role for the king in the Kahuna, and he attempted to serve as the Kohen Gadol. He attempted to bring the incense, the Ketores, in the Beis HaMikdash. Well, that brings us to a landmark event that occurs in the Tanakh, that when he came into the Beis HaMikdash, the Tanakh says there was an earthquake, a rash. So two things happened. There was a physical earthquake itself. The ground shook and split. And he became a leper. He became a leper. He was stricken with leprosy. And in Tanakh we read that everything is dated to this event, Shnosayim Lifnei Arash. This happened 2 years before the earthquake. This happened 2 years after the earthquake. It was a people counted time from that event. That's what an impression it made upon the people, and that was the last attempt of any of the kings of Judah to interfere in the Kahuna. It would only be later in the Second Temple that the Kohanim would interfere and become the kings in the time of the Hashvanoim. But no more would the kings attempt to become the Kohanim, because the lesson of what happened to Uzziah, to Azariah, was so emblazoned on their mind, it was so clear to them that they were afraid to start up. And during his time, again, the war with the kings of the north continued. And during that time, a king called Pekach ben Remaliahu became the king of the northern kingdom, and he made an alliance with Aram, and he attempted to take over in Judah as well. When Uzziahu died, then his son Yosam became the king. Now, Yosam was not good, because, Yosam attempted to follow his father. He was a righteous person in the sense that he did not allow idolatry, but he also was unable to uproot the bomos that existed. And in the Tanakh it says that he built the new gates for the temple in Jerusalem, and the upper city, he rebuilt all of that. But he was unable to stem the war that happened between Pekach ben Remaliahu from the northern kingdom and Ritzin, the king of Aram, conspired against Judah. He was totally ineffective in that. And therefore that served to undermine his kingdom. And when he dies after a 16-year reign, his son Ochaz will come to power. When his son Ochaz comes to power, so then Ochaz turns around completely. Then Ochaz reverts back to idolatry. He reverts back to all of the evils that existed before. And this is the low point, the lowest low point in the kingdom of Judah until the time of the Churban. When Ochaz becomes the king, he undid everything that had been done before him. And Judah is surrounded by enemies. It is powerless, it is small, it's idolatrous. It looks like it's going to be the end. But we'll see that it was only a harbinger of later problems. But it's not the end, because Ochaz himself will have a son, whom I'll discuss with you next time, Chizkiyahu, who is the greatest king after David, and who turns the whole thing around again, and because of him, the Beis HaMikdash is able to last the last 150 years until its eventual destruction.